Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Heart disease and stroke remain two of the top killers in America, according to the American Heart Association's annual statistics this year. Heart disease is the number one cause of death. Stroke is number four. To talk about those sobering statistics and related topics today, we're joined by Dr. Christopher Dibble, a board-certified cardiologist with Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. Dr. Dibble earned his medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He completed residency in internal medicine there as well and completed a combined fellowship in cardiovascular disease, pulmonary disease, and critical care at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He also completed advanced training in pulmonary vascular disease and cardiac imaging and has a master's degree in epidemiology at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Dibble practices all areas of non-invasive cardiology and has a special interest in pulmonary hypertension, heart failure, cardiovascular imaging, and shortness of breath. Dr. Dibble, it's a long introduction, but welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you here. To be part of today's conversation, and I do suggest you call early, 1-800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You could tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Radio. Just use the hashtag VoxPop or email us even, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. All right, we still have a couple minutes left in the show after all that. So, Dr. Dibble, in the green room prior to the show, you said it's an exciting time to be in your line of work. Why?
Well, over the 10 years or so since I finished medical school, the mortality for heart disease, whether it's coronary disease, heart failure, has dropped precipitously. And this is on top of, 30 years of progress, before then. And so we're seeing people commonly survive conditions that they didn't used to survive and survive with a good quality of life. For example, I fairly routinely see people now who have had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest are resuscitated and return home to a good quality of life.
It's amazing.
But
the improvement in our results, it's not because we're any healthier going in, right? It's because of the science and advances in medicine?
I think so. And this generation is actually, I think, fatter and more sedentary than generations before.
Well, we try.
And so I have heard that there are some concerns that this may be the first generation in American history that has a mortality that's worse than the generation before it. But I think it is largely due to our therapeutics. And this is kind of a double-edged sword in that there's so much we can do, but it's also very expensive.
Yeah.
And we're struggling to find ways to deal with that as a healthcare system right now.
The number to call here is Dr. Dibble is 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Christopher Dibble is our guest. Lines are loading up, so let's get right to the phones, and we'll go to Lou in Altamont. Lou, how you doing?
Very good, Ray. Yourself?
Good.
Hey, doctor, I have a question regarding pulmonary hypertension. It's got three parts. First of all, what is it? Is it correctable? And what happens if it is not corrected?
Oh, so three great questions and a particular area of interest for me. So pulmonary hypertension is high blood pressure in your lungs. And so your heart has two pumps. One pumps to your body and generates the blood pressure that you measure in your arm. The other one pumps the blood to your lungs. And so pulmonary hypertension means high blood pressure in your lungs. So that's what it is. What causes it? So there's a lot of causes to it. I like to say that pulmonary hypertension is a little bit like anemia. So you could have anemia that's low blood counts because you have a gunshot wound to the abdomen and you're bleeding. You could have anemia because you've had chemotherapy and your body's is destroying the cells and not making new ones. Or you could have anemia because you're not eating well. So pulmonary hypertension is just a finding that kind of demands an explanation for it. And so or another example would be you can have low oxygen levels because you have a pneumonia or low oxygen levels because you have heart failure or you have, lung disease.
Yeah.
So pulmonary hypertension is a finding that demands an explanation. And so common causes for it would be heart failure. The blood kind of backs up in the lungs and causes the pressures to rise, or lung disease itself, or a lot of Americans would be COPD, or even more mundane conditions such as sleep apnea can cause pulmonary hypertension. So the treatment and the prognosis for pulmonary hypertension largely depends upon the cause and how well the heart is doing pumping blood through those lungs with high pressure. So it's a complicated condition because really it's a finding that is caused by, you know, dozens of different things. And so it's kind of hard to have one answer to it. We could spend the whole hour talking about that.
Right. And I know Lou would love that, but we can't do that. So let's wrap up Lou's call. Lou, you want to follow up?
Just what is the results if it's not corrected and the cause is not heart failure?
Oh, so that's a great question. So pulmonary hypertension, generally speaking, can cause shortness of breath. And then after that, when the heart starts to fail and can't pump the bloods through the lungs, you start to notice swelling in the ankles and just kind of swelling everywhere. If you know someone who has pulmonary hypertension, it's an area of expertise for me, and I'd be happy to see them.
And there's contact information on our website, Lou. It's wamc.org/voxpop. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
How might decreasing cortisol levels act in decreasing the incidence of heart disease and high blood pressure?
Did you get that, Doc? Because there was a bad connection there.
Yeah, I got it. So okay. So the caller asked how cortisol levels affect heart disease and high blood pressure. And so this is something that is not a part of routine clinical care right now. So we do not routinely try to reduce cortisol to improve outcomes in cardiovascular disease. And this is one of those things where you have to be careful in that there are associations that don't necessarily imply causation. So, for example, people with heart attacks may have high cortisol levels. That does not mean that lowering cortisol levels is going to lower heart attacks. And so I would say this is not something that's part of routine clinical care. And even though I believe that relationship exists, heart disease, high cortisol levels, I think it's not something we do routinely. You need to show that lowering it improves outcomes.
And what is cortisol?
Cortisol is a hormone.
Okay.
It's naturally produced, sort of, you know, we give cortisol sometimes. It's a naturally produced stress hormone that generally your body needs it, but too much of it has bad effects on the body.
Jim?
Okay.
Oh, well, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Interesting. You mentioned causation and correlation. And at least up until recently, there was always this caveat with cholesterol-lowering drugs that it'll lower your cholesterol, but it doesn't necessarily mean you've lowered your risk of having a heart attack.
Yes, so cancer lowers your cholesterol levels, generally speaking. So not everything that lowers your cholesterol is necessarily good for you. And so, and where we see this most often is actually your good cholesterol. So your good cholesterol is your HDL. There's a lot of drugs and a couple that have almost made it to approval that raise your good cholesterol but actually increase the incidence of heart disease. And the problem is a lot of the medications that you have what we call off-target effects. So there was a medicine around a couple years ago that raised your HDL cholesterol but also raised your blood pressure and didn't improve cardiovascular disease outcomes. And so there are the flip side, so for your bad cholesterol, your LDL, there are most things that we have found that lower your LDL improve your outcome. So complicated question.
Yeah, indeed. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. It is a Medical Monday. Dr. Christopher Dibble is our guest. Let's go to Carolyn in Red Hook. Carolyn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am familiar with work done by Caldwell Esselstyn Jr., who worked at the Cleveland Clinic for 35 years, a researcher and cardiologist or surgeon. And he wrote a book called Preventing and Reversing Heart Disease, nutrition-based. And the foreword was done by another fellow who did the book, author of the China study, T. Colin Campbell. And I wondered if you were familiar with them. My friend has had great success with changing his diet and improving his numbers hugely.
Yes. So I have to say my familiarity with his research comes from a documentary I've seen, not something I learned in my training.
Ah.
And I would say it brings up an interesting point in that, you know, nutrition is not something that has historically been taught well in medical schools. And so he kind of my recollection is he advocated a plant-based diet.
Yep.
And I think that so a couple things, you know, most Americans, I think, need to focus on the basics, which is avoidance of processed foods, salty foods, refined carbohydrates, big piles of starch, pasta, bread, mm-hmm. white bread,
yep.
And then animal products if you choose to eat them sparingly.
Yes.
And I think that, America 20 years ago launched onto a low-fat diet and then got fatter than it's ever been before.
Yeah, how about that?
And so because that low-fat diet was high in sugar. So if you think back over the last 20 years, that mm-hmm. the low-fat diet, I think, in some ways, led to obesity. So I guess I don't think that there is one diet that you need, but I think in general, a more heavily plant-based diet, free of processed foods and salty foods, is the way to go. And then you asked the second question was, what effects are there on lipids? And so, usually you can get about 10 or 15% if you, based on diet and lifestyle, in terms of improvement in your cholesterol profile. And what the problem with that is let's say your bad cholesterol is 200. If you have heart disease, we want to see that around 50. So it's pretty hard to get your bad cholesterol of 200 down to 50 without some pharmaceuticals. So kind of depends on the patient, how we address that.
Carolyn, thanks a lot for the call. We'll take a break here. We're joined today by Dr. Christopher Dibble. We talk cardiology and whatnot here on A Medical Monday. We'll be back.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York, accepting new patients, nlh.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar, dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. Berkshire Museum, Pittsfield, Immortal Present, Art and East Asia, on view through September 7th, featuring objects from the museum's historic collection of Asian art and works by contemporary artists with ties to Asia, berkshiremuseum.org. The Glass Onion, Block Island, Rhode Island, since 1989 offering apparel, jewelry, body care, books, home and garden supplies, and kids' gear, featuring local vendors, on the island's main street, glassonionblockisland.com. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988, lglc.org. And from Piano Summer at New Paltz, featuring international pianists July 11th through the 31st at SUNY New Paltz, 3 weeks of concerts including a symphony gala with the Hudson Valley Philharmonic, Vladimir Feltzman conducting, newpaltz.edu/piano.
It's Vox Pop. It's a Medical Monday, don't you know? 1-800-348-2551, the telephone number. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok today. We're joined by Dr. Christopher Dibble, and we talk cardiology and related matters with you. On the line is Henry from Sheffield. Henry, you're on. Go.
Hi. I've had a quintuple bypass about 9 years ago, and after that, I was diagnosed as having an aneurysm in my ascending aorta, that is, I guess, on the top of the heart. And it's seems to be expanding so that they say that it's at like 5.5 centimeters or something. Now, if it gets to be much bigger, it'll probably pop, I guess. And the surgeon is anxious. He sort of discouraged me from another open heart surgery after having had this considerable surgery before. I was wondering, is this article that I read in the New York Times on the 22nd of June about transcatheter aortic valve replacement something that might be applicable to me?
So Probably not, but let me just answer a couple, just address a couple things here. So you had a bypass surgery, which means that they took veins or arteries and sewed them to your aorta and then to your heart itself to bypass blockages that were there.
That's right.
So yeah. I'm explaining this for the listeners. So then the question is, that's an open heart surgery, and a second open heart surgery, especially with all those bypass grafts in there, which are essentially pipes, operating around those would be a very difficult surgery. So, you know, if you had nothing else wrong with you and you had never had surgery, generally with your aorta that size, they would want to replace it. So then your second question is about a transcatheter aortic valve replacement. So this is one of the more exciting things to happen in cardiology in the last 10 years. It used to be if you had a leaky, if you had a blocked valve, you would have to have open heart surgery, a couple days in the hospital, you know, what people would refer to as having their chest cracked.
Right.
And have a couple days in the hospital. Nowadays, for certain patients, we can put new valves in it's not a procedure I do, but it can be done through a catheter. So no big incision.
So it goes in under your arm or somewhere?
It goes in the leg or sometimes through the chest wall itself. And so that's done to treat the valve itself. That does not treat the aorta. So that would not be something that would be able to fix that dilated aorta. So it's, you know, this is a question that a surgeon would answer more commonly than a cardiologist. But, you know, everything you said seems pretty reasonable, but you'd have to talk to a surgeon about it.
Okay. Hey, Henry, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Dr. Christopher Dibble is our guest. So after you've already had a bypass, a valve replacement like that is not necessarily the best idea.
Well, if you've had one bypass, people commonly get a second bypass surgery or second valve surgery. It's just higher risk. And so you have to decide, is this somebody who you're going to do an open heart surgery or try to do a transcatheter, a transcatheter procedure. What's, you know, I think is interesting in cardiology is there's lots of ways to do less invasive procedures. And I think you see lots of hospitals marketing less invasive, this, that, or the other thing for every condition. And what you don't want to do is have a less invasive procedure, maybe save yourself a day in the hospital or a little more discomfort from the incision, and then have a surgery that didn't work out well.
Right.
And you're back in the operating room 2 years later. And so all these things are trade-offs.
How common are valve replacements nowadays?
Really common. I mean, I'd say that all the major medical centers in the capital region do them. They're really pretty common procedures.
And is it artificial valves now or pig valves still on vogue?
Well, so we have pig valve. We have what we call a tissue valve, and then there's metal valves.
Yeah.
So the metal valves tend to last longer. You put them in younger people, but then they require blood thinners for the rest of their lives. Whereas the tissue valves don't require any blood thinners, but they don't last quite as long. So those tend to go into older patients.
So what do you mean by not quite as long? How long would the average tissue valve last?
10 years or so, at least.
So,
and it's getting better as the technology improves.
So if you outlive the valve and you're up there in age, will you get a new valve or is that it?
Yeah, you'll get a new valve. Yeah. People commonly go in for a reoperation for a new valve. Or, you know, sometimes now even not commonly, very, very uncommonly, they can be fixed with a new valve through a catheter. That's an unusual procedure, but it's done occasionally.
Pretty exciting advances.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Bill in Albany. Bill, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Dibble. Thanks for taking my call. My dad he's had high cholesterol with a history of heart problems. He had a heart attack at 49. He had open heart surgery, and his cholesterol is still high, although he's on a statin and he's on another medicine as well to bring his cholesterol down. His doctor at home had told him about a PCSK9 inhibitor. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so PCSK9. So this is a new medication that's been voted to, I don't believe it's actually officially approved, but the advisory panel voted to suggest approval. And it's a medicine that on top of a statin, or for patients who are statin intolerant, lowers your cholesterol even more. It's what's going to be interesting about this. I don't think we've totally figured out exactly how this is going to fit into clinical practice. We figured out it's safe and it's effective. I don't think we figured out how we're going to use it. When it gets approved, what's going to be interesting is who will insurance pay for it? It's going to be very, very expensive. So who gets it in what settings? So, you know, this is a growing problem we have in cardiology in that we have all these effective therapies. And over the last couple of years, you know, maybe, I don't know, a dozen new ones in terms of medications. And they're tremendously expensive, you know, $500, $600, $700 a month or even more. And so this is going to be another one that I suspect, although I don't know the pricing yet, is going to be in that range.
Wow.
Thousands a year, thousands of dollars a year. And so what's going to be interesting is this is a drug that's only going to be covered for people who have, you know, congenital cholesterol defects where their cholesterol is, for instance, 400 or 500 compared to, you know, your average person with cardiovascular disease, like maybe I would guess your father, has, you know, cholesterols in the 100 or 200 range.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an interesting question to see kind of what this looks like when it gets to market. And I think it's an open question right now.
Bill, thanks a lot. It seems like a couple $1,000 a month is an awful lot of money to pay for something that is fairly untested. Yeah, it's been voted to be moving on and be approved, but there's not a long track record there, is there?
Well, I don't know the actual cost, but this has been, I'm guessing it's going to be hundreds of dollars a month.
Yeah.
This has been tested in clinical trials, and so I think it'll be new to market, but I think it'll be fairly well tested. But actually, what's interesting about it is it's tested in clinical trials for people who have, you know, congenital cholesterol abnormalities, which are fairly unusual. And what has not been tested and what will not be perfect, do you add it on to a statin there?
That Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine, John in Poughkeepsie. John, you're on.
Yes. I had surgery up at St. Peter's about 15 years ago. A triple bypass, and they took a vein out of my leg. And at the time, they said, well, it's a good about 15 years, and that's about 15 years ago. And they do have people down in Poughkeepsie at Vassar Hospital and places like that. But I thought because they did such a good job, and I am losing, you know, I'm beginning to feel like I was before I had open heart surgery. And I'm just curious to know whether or not they would repeat the procedure if I needed it, or do they just work with stents now? Or
yeah, great question. So questions, how long does a bypass graft last for? And I have a very simple, easy answer to that, which is it depends. And so you can have these new bypass grafts put on, and then if you smoke, don't manage your cholesterol, don't exercise, don't take an aspirin, they may not last very long. So, you know, 10 or 15 years is when the grafts do commonly start to wear out. And so in general, how long your bypass lasts for depends upon, you know, what kind of grafts you got and where were they put, and a lot of technical details.
Hmm.
But what I would say is, in general, with coronary disease, and I think this is actually a key thing for, you know, coronary diseases, there's not much you need to do invasive if you're feeling okay. So if you had a bypass surgery 15 years ago and you're feeling fine, you don't need to do much other than manage your risk factors. You don't need to worry about should someone be going in there and doing some sort of operation on me. But you said you're not feeling well, and I'd say the next step would be to do a stress test and see, not your doctor, but, you know, I would guess that your doctor would suggest a stress test. And then after that, you can look to see, and sometimes you suggest a repeat bypass surgery if there's major problems, but oftentimes nothing needs to be done or a stent needs to be put in. And I would say, you know, St. Peter's is a great hospital with great cardiologists, and, you know, if you have a doctor there who you like and know, you should stick with them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks, John. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Ina in Woodridge, New York. You're on, Ina.
Hello there.
Hello.
I'm calling about my son-in-law. He has his heart stops beating for a few seconds and his blood pressure goes down and they can't figure out what's causing it. They gave up.
So tough to do that over the phone.
Yes.
For me. But in general, you asked about an arrhythmia, and arrhythmia is an irregular heartbeat. And I would say you kind of have to know, is the heart structurally normal? Does he, you know, did the valves work? Does the heart work fine? Does he have blockages in the arteries? Because, you know, an arrhythmia is kind of an overall category of problems of which there are, you know, hundreds of different types of problems one might have. So it can be a tricky question. In general, when we're trying to diagnose an arrhythmia, what we'll often, you know, the initial step obviously is, maybe it's not obvious, is an EKG.
Just yeah.
Put the wires on your chest. And then if we really run into trouble, what we do after that is we have someone put the EKG wires on and they have a little box they carry around about the size of a deck of cards that actually records their heart rate, their heart rhythm continuously for a day or even a month. And so there's lots to be done to figure that out. Kind of hard to give a more specific answer.
No, well, the problem is that they did do the EKG. I don't know whether they did that, though, to leave it on. And all I'm saying is that, you know, they did all they said that they could, and they have no idea why it's happening.
Well, that's, you know, another interesting technology we have, and it's hard to know what the problem is in your particular cases. We actually now have what we call an implantable loop recorder, which is a little computer about the size of maybe a third of a Bic pen that goes under the skin and continuously records the heart rate totally underneath the skin, the heart rhythm, and we can interrogate it with a computer and actually get a recording of what happened. And that can, you know, basically provide real-time recording of your heart rhythm for up to a year or for a year or more.
Amazing.
Okay, I'm going to suggest this to them.
Ina, thank you so much for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. I knew an older gentleman some years ago who had a pacemaker, and I swear there was some technology involved, and it's a little hazy now. It was several years ago. He called a number, and somehow the readings were done.
Yeah, so we
from internal.
Yeah, so the pacemaker is a little device that has a wire that hooks to the heart but sits under the skin. It's about the size of an Oreo cookie. And a lot of our patients now will have a little computer that sits next to the bedside and contacts the office basically over the internet and sends diagnostic data in terms of what's going on with their pacemaker.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones we go. Walker in Lee, Mass. Walker, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling to ask about cholesterol because all my life I've had high cholesterol. Like, since I was 12, it's been higher than 170. And recently I've been trying different diets to get my cholesterol to go down, but even switching to like a plant-based diet and cutting sugars and fats from it that are, you know, excess, my numbers keep going up and my doctor's threatening a statin. I really don't want to go on one, but what are my options? Really?
Yeah, well, a lot of your cholesterol is genetic. And so I think some people find this frustrating that they can live a fairly pristine lifestyle and still have high cholesterol. And so you have to, you know, the way we prescribe statins these days is to look at your overall risk of heart disease. And if you have, the doctor kind of has to piece together what is your risk of heart disease and how old you are. And it's a tough question that requires, you know, a thorough review of your medical history. You know, what's interesting is, you know, having a really high cholesterol, there's two issues here. There's the issue of dose and duration. So if you have a really high cholesterol from a young age, that's actually probably, or even a moderately high cholesterol from a young age, that long duration of even when you say dose, they say the level of the cholesterol, a long duration of a high cholesterol is probably really bad. And what we're learning this from is genetic studies. So people who genetically, you know, there are people who, you know, your bad cholesterol, your LDL may be, let's say, 150. There are people who genetically have an LDL of 19, which, you know, I couldn't get patients there with medications, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And those patients don't really develop coronary disease, or they develop very late in life. And so it's frustrating. It's a genetic thing. And whether or not you treat is a decision that has to be individualized.
Okay. And what are, like, the long-term risks of, say, taking a statin for 40 years?
So I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that. I would say that I think we think it's probably okay, and you kind of have to weigh the risks and benefits. I mean, you don't really see, as a physician, you know, people walking around with terrible outcomes from statins. In other words, I don't see people hospitalized because they've had some complication from a statin. Yes, they cause muscle aches, but really that's the only thing you kind of commonly see, about 4% of people, 5% of people. And so, you know, do we know over 40 years? No, we don't know that answer yet.
How long have there been studies on statins?
Statins hit the market, I think, in the early 90s.
Really? And that's all?
Yeah, they were around before then. You know, I think the compounds were around since the 70s at least, but they weren't really used much till the 90s. And then over the years, we've had newer and newer statins that are sort of more potent.
So long-term effects, still an open book.
Well, I think we think long-term they're pretty safe. But when I say long-term, I'm very comfortable telling a 50- or 60-year-old that they're going to be fine from this. I feel I have a little more reservation saying that to a 30-year-old. And you have to understand, when I see a 50 or 60-year-old, I often will calculate their 10-year risk of having a heart attack. And it's very common to get numbers such as 15%. So that's if you're 50 years old, you have a risk of 15% from age 60 to 50 to 60. Then 60 to 70, maybe your risk is 20. So you're talking a 35, 40% risk of heart disease. If you have a 50-year-old in front of you, you can often say by the time you're 80, you have a 40% chance of having a heart attack. And the risks from the statin are probably much smaller than that 40% chance of heart attack.
But is there a study that says, yeah, the statin will lower your risk of heart attacks?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, definitively.
Absolutely.
Numerous studies.
So good cholesterol high, bad cholesterol low will, in fact, lower your risk of heart attacks.
So where it becomes a little dicey, where the controversy is. So there is no controversy in the medical community about statins for people who have heart attacks.
Who have already had one. Okay.
And people who have already had a heart attack or stroke, we call that secondary prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Where the controversy exists is primary prevention. So someone who has never had a heart attack or stroke,
right.
Do you treat them because their cholesterol is high? And that's what the caller is asking about. And so, and someone who has had a secondary prevention, someone who has had a heart attack or stroke, I can tell them a statin is going to decrease your chance of dying and decrease your chance of heart attack and stroke. For a primary prevention patient, this may be a 50-year-old with a high cholesterol, I can tell them this is going to decrease your chance of heart attack and stroke. I'm not sure it's going to decrease your chance of dying. That question is...
Well, I mean, the chance of dying is 100%.
Dying from heart disease, or lower your risk of dying from heart disease.
Okay. Our guest, and that's very interesting.
And actually, and the problem with this is it is very difficult to study events that are rare. So if heart attacks and people who, primary prevention, someone's never had a heart attack, if I want to show that giving statins to a 30-year-old prevents their risk of heart attack, I'm going to have to study millions of 30-year-olds because the events are so uncommon.
Yeah.
Whereas if I have an event where the chance is 50% and I lower it to 40, that's going to be an easier thing to show in a study.
Good point. Our guest today is Dr. Christopher Dibble, and we will be back on Vox Pop. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, a community healthcare system providing emergency cardiac, stroke, cancer, and emergency care, ellismedicine.org. Munson Williams Proctor Arts Institute Museum, Utica, New York, presenting Monet to Matisse, The Age of French Impressionism. Original works by Monet, Degas, Renoir, Cézanne, Matisse, and more, mwpai.org. The Urological Institute Urological Oncology Services, evidence-based comprehensive care for all stages of prostate cancer, featuring Uronav MRI-guided diagnostics to help detect prostate cancer, urologyoncology.com. Pirates Lakeside Grill on Nassau Lake, serving local grass-fed beef, Milwaukee hot dogs and sausages, beer-battered fish fry, and handmade milkshakes. PiratesLakesideGrill.com. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. And from Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival, Wednesday through Sunday, Netherlands Dance Theater 2 in a U.S. appearance, and Big Dance Theater from New York, jacobspillow.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC Medical Monday. Dr. Christopher Dibble is our guest. He is a certified cardiologist with Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. And the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. It's the home stretch now of the program. Let's go to Dawn, or is it Devon? Dawn? It's Dawn in Delmar.
Dawn.
I can't read the writing. Hi, Dawn. You're on.
Great. Thanks. I have WPW, and I had cardiac catheter ablation. And they were able to zap one of the extra electrical pathways, but there was one left that was too close to some high-risk area, so they left that there. Anyway, the bottom line is, after having the procedure, my heartbeat is permanently altered, and it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like a normal. It beats harder. I don't know how else to explain it. So I wondered how this... if this sounds right, or or if I need to, I mean, I do have a couple other questions about it. So is that something you can speak
to? So the caller has an extra electrical circuit in the heart and mentioned they had a catheterization. Most people are probably familiar with catheterizations in the sense of having a stent put in, to open a blockage in one of the arteries. The caller had a catheterization where there was actually a little burn made or a freezing area of cold applied to an area, to one of those areas to interrupt a circuit. And so what we call that an electrophysiology procedure or an ablation. And certainly ablations can alter the rhythm of the heart. And so generally what we would do here is try to probably have you wear a monitor and correlate your symptoms with what the arrhythmia is. And so there's a variety of different arrhythmias and problems that you could have. And so it's sort of tough to know. Your doctor should, you have a monitor and tell you what the rhythm was at the time you were feeling these things.
Okay. All right. So that's something, in other words, that he could look at, because it just seems so, it's not like I'm having, the rapid heartbeat incidents. It's not like I'm having that. It's a different thing completely, but you're saying it's something that should show up when compared to an earlier, like EKG.
Or you don't even need to compare it. You should probably have an arrhythmia that you're feeling. It's probably just a different one than you had initially.
I mean, could there be a psychological component, Dawn? In other words, you've had an issue that caused some sort of medical thing, and now you're hypersensitive to everything?
No, because,
every beat of your heart?
I suppose, but I have done a number of things to. What does the doctor think of that, rather than me?
Well, so that's a really interesting question. I kind of agree with both of you, and so probably pretty much everybody has extra heartbeats or things we call PVCs or PACs, just kind of premature or extra contractions. And so some people notice them, some people don't. And some people notice them more at certain times of their life or times of day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may be more, you may have always had some of these things and you're noticing them more, or you may be having them more often. I mean, it could be either. It's really difficult to know.
All right, Dawn, we got to run along, but thank you so much for the call. Here's one that came in via email, Doctor. This is from Doug in Albany. What new imaging is out there now, and what is just around the corner for being able to image the arteries to see level of blockages in a less invasive way?
Oh, that's a great question. So, right now, there's two types of ways of imaging the arteries around your heart. There's what we call an anatomic test, and that's just where are the blockages and how bad are they. And then there's another one called a functional type of test. So a functional test would be I put you on a treadmill and have you run and see how you feel and see what your EKG looks like.
Yeah.
That's kind of the traditional standard. And then the anatomic tests are we actually take pictures of the heart. And so traditionally, the way to look for blockages was a cardiac catheterization. It's a surgery and an operating room. And what's coming along now is greater use of CT scanners. So we used to, the heart's moving and it's moving fairly quickly, a heartbeat every second.
Yeah.
And taking a picture can take a long time. So we have, CT scanners, MRIs. And I'd say that the kind of the most up-and-coming way of looking at the heart blood vessels is a CT scanner. The Achilles heel of all of these technologies is the radiation exposure. The amount of radiation Americans get from medical procedures is really remarkably increased since the 1980s.
It's still very low, right?
No. I mean, in terms of the growth of medical radiation, it's really been astronomical over the last 20
years. But, isn't it a very low level as far as your long-term risk?
So that's a difficult question. So if I take a 30-year-old, I'm going to kind of make these numbers up, but they're roughly right. If I take a 30-year-old woman and advise her to have a CT scan or a nuclear stress test, that may increase her lifetime risk of cancer 0.5% or 1%. And so, and then you do that thousands of times to the population and you've caused a lot of cancer. And so on the other hand, if I take an 80-year-old gentleman who has coronary disease, who may die from heart disease or stroke, probably not going to die from that radiation, probably very little effect of that radiation. So you kind of have to look at who's getting the radiation and when.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Bill in Albany. Bill.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm calling because I'm 65 years old and there's a history of paternal heart problems in my family. So my doctor suggested that I have an aorta ultrasound, and it was determined that I have a plaque buildup. We don't know how much, but a plaque buildup of abdominal aorta. In other words, there's a plaque buildup in my abdominal aorta. And so I'm going to see my doctor, my primary, in about 3 weeks, and I'm assuming he's going to somehow measure, determine how much of a buildup there is. What can you tell me about abdominal aorta plaque, when there, if there's a small amount, medium, or a large amount?
Were you a smoker?
I quit in 86.
So, backing up a little bit. So, the aorta is a pipe about, you know, a little smaller than a garden hose that extends from your heart and distributes the blood to your body. So, it should be, you know, fairly small, and it goes into your abdomen. And so, an abdominal aortic aneurysm is when it grows. And so, it can grow from the size of a garden hose and then kind of get this turn into a something the size of more like of a grapefruit.
Wow.
And so, that's called an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And there's a recommendation now that I think is not followed as much as it should be, that every male aged 65 to 75 who's ever smoked should have an ultrasound of their abdominal aorta. So sounds like your doctor did that, which is great. And then they found plaque. And so I would say that's a marker of increased risk of cardiovascular, of having, you know, a stroke or a heart attack. And your doctor should, you know, look through your cardiovascular risk profile with you, which would generally involve checking your cholesterol and reviewing your lifestyle and probably treating you with a statin if you already have plaque there.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Bill. Over to Eileen in Tilson. Eileen, you're on.
Yes. Hello. Can you tell me, please, what the relationship is between non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and chest pain? And also, can a layperson distinguish between chest pain caused by gas or by a heart problem?
Okay, so first, non-steroidal drugs. So people should know that on the market, in terms of over-the-counter painkillers, there's Tylenol, which is always known as acetaminophen, and everything else. So Tylenol sits on its own, or Tylenol and acetaminophen, and everything else is ibuprofen, naproxen, Aleve, all those other meds. And so non-steroidals and chest pain are kind of a complicated relationship, but in general, they can non-steroidals can cause significant irritation to your GI tract and cause chest pain. And they, on the other hand, if you pull a muscle in your chest, they can also be used to treat chest pain. And it is very difficult to tell the difference between GI-related chest pain, so gastrointestinal chest pain, and cardiac chest pain. And I'd say that's even difficult for healthcare providers. Yeah, generally, if you're experiencing chest pain and it's a new symptom, you got to either talk to your doctor or get medical attention.
Yeah. I had a non-steroidal as a patch, and it also caused chest pain. So does that mean that the NSAID affects the heart?
So two questions there. Generally speaking, if the NSAIDs are going to cause discomfort in the chest or abdomen, it does it through irritation of the stomach.
Okay.
But there's been an interesting controversy recently in that we used to say these drugs were pretty safe for the heart. But, you know, more recently we found that ibuprofen probably slightly ibuprofen, otherwise known as
Motrin.
Advil.
Motrin. Yeah, Advil, Motrin. Slightly increases your risk of coronary disease.
Huh.
Not where, if you're healthy, you shouldn't take it. But if you have coronary disease, naproxen, if you need to take an NSAID, is probably a little better. And what's interesting to me about these medications is I think they're actually really dangerous drugs. And I always wonder if they were coming to the market now, if we would approve them for over-the-counter use. And that NSAIDs are bad for if you're advanced in age, you're elderly, they're really pretty bad for you. They're bad for your stomach. They can be bad for your heart. They can cause heart failure. They can cause kidney disease. And, you know, comparing an NSAID, you know, comparing ibuprofen to, for instance, one of the statins, it's like a no-brainer that the NSAIDs are much more dangerous.
Well, Eileen, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Over to Sally in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Sally.
Yes. I have primary pulmonary hypertension. I have been treated successfully with medicine for 12 years, and I'm just wondering where we are today in regards to treatment and latest research.
Well, we still don't know the cause of that disease. So that condition went from having no treatments in the mid-90s to having about 15 approved right now. So there's a couple new medications in the pipeline for that. And there's also a couple of the older medications are now becoming available to be used in sort of, you know, more easier to deliver. So we used to put, you know, intravenous lines in people and leave them there permanently. And now some of those medications are available orally.
Okay.
So, you know, pulmonary hypertension, fairly unusual condition. And in the past, very expensive and difficult to treat, but lots and lots of new medications for it.
Okay, terrific. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sally. What fast calls. 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Christopher Dibble. Christy in North Adams. Christy, your turn.
Hi. I have an outrageously high level of cholesterol, somewhere in the low 200s. And all of the statin drugs I have tried have exacerbated my tendency to tendinitis.
Hmm.
And I get horrible leg cramps. I'd like to take one. Is there such a thing as taking a drug every other day?
Yeah, so statin intolerance is pretty common.
Good.
And we generally don't want to tell someone that they, you know, really you should stay away from a statin until they've tried three different statins, which it sounds like you have.
Yeah.
So, and then after, you know, there's a lot of strategies for dealing with statin intolerance. One of them is every other day, three times a week. Some people even have found, you know, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. All those are probably better than not taking them.
Hmm.
So then what are the next options beyond statins? So there's older medications that are even more difficult to tolerate that work to lower your cholesterol. They have a lot of GI side effects, not really used much, but they're cheap and widely available. And then there's some newer things that, so for instance, we could actually put a catheter in people and what we call ferrete away the lipids. I'm not sure if anyone does that locally, but it's
I've not heard it done, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Is that something that is done once a month or?
Yeah, it's done frequently. I don't know the exact interval, but I'd say that, you know, that's something I've had less interest in pursuing. You know, we've actually talked about offering that for our patients because there's a couple new meds coming in the pipeline. And, you know, one caller asked earlier about the PCSK9 inhibitors that are probably going to be, you know, really, really helpful for people who are statin intolerant.
Mm.
So I'd say,
that sounds really promising then.
Yeah, and so I think what's going to be interesting, though, is, you know, cholesterol level 200 is high, not terrible. And, you know, will you be able to get that med approved and paid for? Because it's going to be very expensive.
Ah.
Well, it's our tax money that pays for
well,
it.
All right.
We would have to see.
Well, I'm happy to chip in, Christy. Thanks a lot.
Me too.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, so Bob in Schenectady. Bob, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Yes, I have really good cholesterol. My good cholesterol is, I don't know the exact number. I think it's in the 70s, and my total cholesterol is about 145. And yet my doctor wants me on statin, pravastatin, 10 milligrams, three times a week because I had calcium. I had a calcium scan done. I had calcium around my heart.
So that's an interesting question. So it used to be, and I think this is what people are still familiar with, the recommendation of the American Heart Association was take a statin if your cholesterol is high. If your cholesterol is low, you don't need a statin. And the problem with that is people with low cholesterols also benefit from statins. Just they have a reduction in their heart attack and stroke risk. The reduction just isn't quite as great as someone with a really high cholesterol. And so I would say that your doctor sounds like they're probably a pretty good one and that's a very contemporary regimen that a lot of doctors would say, oh, no, your cholesterol is fine. Don't worry about it. That's the way we did things years ago. But it sounds like you probably have a good doctor with a fairly up-to-date recommendation.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
The calcium that's in my arteries, that doesn't necessarily have to stay there, right? I mean, that can decrease after a time or...
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. So one way... there's two ways to look for coronary disease. We used to look for what we call clinical coronary disease, you know, see if you have symptoms. But a lot of people come in now and say, well, I don't want to wait till I have symptoms or I have a heart attack. I want to know now, do I have trouble? And so we call that looking for preclinical disease, and that's looking at calcium. So I think we're probably running short on time here, but
we are.
What I would tell you is
as
your arteries start to heal and you decrease your risk, the calcium can actually go up. So those calcium scores are a good once-in-a-lifetime test. Serially, they're not helpful. So you probably shouldn't have that looked at again.
Yeah, and the calcium could be from taking supplements also. I didn't have anything in my arteries 3 years ago. I had a lot of scans and x-rays for an operation. I had no calcium. And then I went in, I had hip problem. They scanned for my hip, and I saw it in my femoral artery. And I'm thinking it's probably the calcium supplements that I've been taking. I've read something about that can cause the, you know, when you're taking too much calcium, it can go into your arteries.
Hey, Bob, we're just about done here, but go ahead, Doc. You can
wrap it up. I'm not sure of. That's a complicated question.
All right, Bob, thank you very much. Dr. Dibble, well done. You have fun?
Yeah, that was great. Thanks
good
for having me.
Nice to have you here. And thanks to everybody who called in today. Support comes from the New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, serving the public for over 30 years, 800-342-3661. H. Houst and Son True Value, Woodstock, New York. Since 1932, a local hardware store for summer projects and grills and party supplies for outdoor fun. True Value, behind every project is a true value. HHoust.com. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com, and Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years, from digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more, paradisecopies.com. Thanks again to Dr. Christopher Dibble of Cardiology Associates of Schenectady at Ellis Medicine. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to all the great calls and the emails today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, who's yawning. Well, I mean, that's an insult, Zach. You got to look awake. Thanks to our call screener, who was Joe. Joe did the screening today. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Thanks for being here. Tomorrow, another fine program that I don't know what it is, but we'll figure it out, and we'll be here tomorrow at 2:00.